This is Building Bridges, your community and labor report, produced and hosted by Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash.
On today's program, we present a wide-ranging interview with George Galloway, former member of the British Parliament and founder of Viva Palestina, on the key role of the U.S. in changing Israeli apartheid policies toward the Palestinians. But first, we go to a recent speech you gave in Brooklyn, New York, on fighting the Israeli blockade of Gaza.
The chairman, in his kind introduction, talked about the three convoys in the last 12 months or so that I was privileged to lead through the siege into Gaza. 550 of us drove all the way from London in our ambulances, in our vehicles filled with aid, through Europe into Greece, from Greece into Turkey, where we aligned ourselves with the greatest humanitarian organization I have ever met, the Turkish organization IHH, $120 million a year humanitarian organization, working all over the world, but with special emphasis on Palestine. Our convoy doubled overnight. We were joined by hundreds of Turkish activists. The IHH organization was founded by the Turkish leader and hero of the Islamic world, Tayyip Erdogan. That when we 550 with hundreds of vehicles arrived at the port of Al-Arish in Egypt. Once there in the port, we were locked up like animals day after day. No one was allowed out. No one was allowed in. There were no toilet facilities. We were treated like the worst kind of criminals by an Arab Muslim country, when all we were trying to do was take medicine to the Palestinian people who were dying for the want of it, just a few kilometers from where we were imprisoned. When the order came, they attacked us with savagery. 55 of our 550 entered Gaza the next day, still bleeding from the attacks of these Egyptian security forces. And we entered Gaza with this huge convoy to a predictable welcome from the Palestinians in Gaza. And huge though our aid was, it was, of course, again, just a drop in the ocean of troubles afflicting the Palestinians under siege. Don't forget what's happening there. People are eating food from garbage heaps. 80% of the Palestinians in Gaza are unemployed. 80% of them are living on less than $1 a day. And 80% of the children of Gaza are medically, clinically suffering from malnutrition or undernutrition. People can't get medicine, can't get medical help, can't get out for operations, are imprisoned and besieged in this tiny piece of land, 25 miles long, 4.5 miles wide, and are imprisoned not just by Israel, but by the Arab Republic of Egypt, by the tin pot dictatorship of Hosni Mubarak. But I tell you, if it was not for the dictatorship in Egypt, there would be no siege on Gaza. The Rafah gate could be open. All those children could have food, could have medicine. The doctors could come and go. There would be no siege if it were not for the collaborator regime, for the moment, still in power in Cairo. At the same time, they announced there would be no more convoys would be allowed to enter Gaza through Egypt. And of course, none can enter Gaza through Israel. So they thought that they had stopped the efforts to break the siege on Gaza. but they forgot about the sea. For those who have the courage to take to it, it is possible to enter Gaza by sea, and that's what we're doing under the leadership of the Turkish IHH. There are many tensions, many difficulties. State politics, international politics is, of course, involved. But the convoy goes with the blessing of the government of Turkey. Most of the people and most of the ships and most of the aid are Turkish. On the judgment day, on the last day, we will be asked by the Almighty what we did. And we'll be able to say, we tried to take ships into Gaza. Israel can answer for any refusal of the humanitarian aid. But we at least will be able to place before the Almighty our own records and our own efforts. Viva Palestina is a part of the convoy under the leadership of IHH. Viva Palestina USA exists. I hope you'll go to its website. I hope you'll support its work, vivapalestinausa.org.
I'm standing here with George Galloway in the middle of my neighborhood in Brooklyn.
It's a great neighborhood. It's a wonderful neighborhood, I must say.
Across the street, there's almost a complete population of Chinese in the park. There's a Mexican population, and then, of course, there's the Palestinian population. That's Brooklyn. But of course, on a more serious and dire note, there's almost not a day that goes by when material is not blanked out of the newspapers about the plight of the Palestinian. But when it is there, there is not a day that goes by that doesn't relate to the death of the Palestinian people, whether it's by the mass conditions or by the militarism of Israel, aided certainly by the armed might of the U.S.
That's true, and a lot of Palestinians have died, but by the grace of God, more have been born than have been killed, and Israel will not be able to kill its way out of this Palestinian problem, which it has. During the Gaza war of 22 days, 1,416 Palestinians were killed, but far more Palestinians were born in that 22 days. It's not a population that's going to go away, neither is it going to give up. And the most remarkable thing about the absolutely miserable, dire circumstances in Gaza, which I shall describe having recently been there with our third Viva Palestina convoy, is not the misery. That's very real. But the spirit of determination and defiance, which is imbued throughout the population, man, woman and child. And I never met anybody in Gaza who's ready to surrender. So neither is starvation the answer to Israel's problems. They have to sit down and negotiate with the Palestinian people, not just under their occupation or behind the walls of their siege, but the Palestinian population across the world. Because the Palestinians here in the Whitney Hall in Brooklyn have rights. They have land, they have houses, they have patrimony, which is denied them. There will be no solution which leaves them out. A comprehensive solution, I believe, on the basis of a single democratic state from the Jordan River to the Mediterranean Sea, where all the Jews and the Muslims and the Christians can live as equal citizens. The emphasis on equal citizens. One man, one woman, one vote, one government, one state. That was good enough for post-apartheid South Africa, and in my view, it's good enough for post-apartheid Palestine.
And what would bring the Israeli to the table in a serious way to really negotiate and not just play like the negotiating and increase their settlements and tighten the noose around the Palestinians?
Well, that's what those of us of your generation and mine would call the $64,000 question. That's when $64,000 was a lot of money. That question can only be answered here, and that's why I'm spending so much time in the United States. I always put it this way. If I persuaded every last person in Britain to support the Palestinians, it would be wonderful, but it wouldn't make any difference. But if we can change things here in the United States, then it follows that Israel would have to make that negotiation, because every bullet, every rocket, every helicopter gunship, every F-16, every warship, every salary of every soldier that keeps the Zionist state in its posture of occupation and siege comes from the United States of America. The taxpayer alone gives $7 million a day to Israel, a country of 6 million people, which is actually a relatively rich country. The United States has a lot of problems of its own. Houses are being repossessed, jobs are being lost, unemployment is at least 10%, public services are in a state of decay, and yet you're handing out $7 million a day to a small country thousands of miles away. If the American people really knew that, and really knew what that money was being spent on, then they might begin to question it. And then if you add the private philanthropy of the American Jewish community and the broader American Zionist community, which of course is largely fundamentalist Christian, then that $7 million a day probably doubles. So $14 million a day going out of the United States to Israel. If you turned that tap off, if you got a reevaluation along the lines of General Petraeus, I never thought I'd find myself praying and aid General Petraeus, but his comment in front of the Armed Services Committee that the United States' unequal relationship with Israel is, and I quote him, a strategic liability for the United States. This is a very important, groundbreaking statement. He's the most senior American, and the Armed Services Committee is the most prestigious forum in which that L word has ever been uttered. And it has the benefit of being true. The principal reason why so many people in the world hate the United States of America, and by extension its people and its interests, is because it is a known fact in the world that Israel can commit the crimes that it commits only because of the largesse of the United States taxpayer, the United States government, and private philanthropy from the United States.
Just the other week, it was announced that President Obama is going to commit an extraordinary amount of money again to the Israeli military with the caveat or the rationalization of missiles that are lopped into, quote-unquote, its territory by various groupings within the Palestinian community. So what do you say to President Obama, who certainly does not seem to have had any real rapprochement or any critically different strategy of capitulation to Israel than did the Bush administration?
I don't know that I entirely agree with that for reasons which I'll adumbrate. But one thing is for sure, that President Obama doesn't have the alibi that the last fellow had of being an imbecile. President Obama, he's the smartest president you've ever had. And he knows the truth. He sat with the late and great Professor Edward Said for long enough to know the real truth about this subject. So he hasn't got that alibi. So if he gets to the end of his 4 years, or hopefully 8 years, and he hasn't done anything to bring that truth to bear, then he will stand indicted in a way that Bush has not. I'll tell you why I don't entirely agree with you. Of course it's true that you cannot break from the historic policy of the United States towards Israel overnight and abruptly. But the mood music seems to me, starting from the speech in Cairo, which was a very powerful and important speech, and identified concepts that no American president has ever identified before, comparing, for example, the lot of the Palestinian people with the lot of African Americans historically, the concept that Palestine was not just those living in the occupied territories, but those in exile also, the unacceptability, his word, of the situation in the refugee camps. So far he's accepting them, but he did say they were unacceptable. But most importantly, the visit of Vice President Biden, the humiliation delivered to the United States by Netanyahu, the visit to the White House by Netanyahu when President Obama walked out of his own office, leaving Netanyahu sitting there, telling him, call me when you have something to say. The humiliation of Ban Ki-moon by the same Netanyahu administration, the United Nations Secretary General, and the comments by Petraeus, which I believe have an echo inside the White House. Things are moving, things are changing, and I believe that the United States policy towards the region is underneath, out of view, in a state of flux.
Just recently, Noam Chomsky was denied entrance to the West Bank Not long before that, Robert Fisk was denied entrance and held for some hours. And it would seem that the movements within Israel, such the peace movement, have engaged in a period of quietude, and that the Israelis themselves are more recalcitrant and hardened in their positions against the Palestinian people. And yet you continue to be supremely optimistic about the resilience of the Palestinian people. But how do you feel about what actually is happening in Israel in relationship to their acquiescence or quietude about the atrocities, really, that are committed against the Palestinians?
Well, I think that's a very acute set of observations. The people of Israel, at the end of the 22-day massacre in Gaza, threw out the perpetrators of that massacre and elected people even more extreme than those who had carried out this massacre. And that's, on one level, quite a dismaying circumstance. But, you know, I was heavily involved in the struggle against apartheid in South Africa. The Boers, the settlers there, and bear in mind that Israel is a settler state, just like South Africa was, the Boers always said they were in favor of peace, but they were never prepared to pay the price of peace, which was justice and equality for the Africans, who were 85% of the population there. The same is true in the settler state of Israel. They say that they want peace process, road maps, and even Oslo, although Netanyahu doesn't recognize Oslo. The majority of Israelis probably still do. But when it comes to paying the price for those things, they're not prepared to pay it. That's why I come back here to the United States. They have to be made to pay the price for this recalcitrance that you identify. At the moment, they can be as recalcitrant as they like. They still get the money. They still get the weapons. They still get the most favored nation status. They still get treated like they're not just an honored member of the international community, but there are special rules and laws for them, which allow them to do things that no other country would get away with. In parenthesis, I'd talk about the nuclear issue. Iran is being sanctioned and threatened with war when it does not have any nuclear weapons, and it is a signatory to the Non-Proliferation Treaty. Whilst Israel has hundreds of nuclear weapons, refuses to sign the Non-Proliferation Treaty, and is not punished but endlessly rewarded. So, as long as that's going on, why should they change? If you can have everything you want and nobody makes you pay for it, why would you change? So, the world, starting here in the United States, to a lesser degree the European Union, to a significant degree the Arab world, which is doing virtually nothing about this state of affairs that we're describing, even though they very definitely could if they wanted to, will have to start making Israel pay a price for this continued denial of basic Palestinian rights, never mind a permanent solution to the overarching crisis. So that's why I'm here on the road on this speaking tour in the United States. I want to try to play my part in building up a lobby in public opinion here that can begin to change things, to begin to levy that price.
I did want to ask you about that lobby of public opinion. You're here a lot, but you see snapshots of U.S. public opinion. So I wanted to ask you about breaking the blockade of Gaza, but also I wanted to ask you about the efforts to boycott Israel going on in the United States and around the world. Do you see changes in the U.S. popular opinion and action around these issues?
I do, but not sufficient, of course. But I was a few days ago at the University of California in Berkeley. There's a monumental, titanic struggle around the issue of divestment. It's been vetoed for now, but it will come back. And on campuses throughout the United States, this issue is being raised. And we have to win an appreciation here, and indeed around the world, that dealing with apartheid Israel is just as dishonorable a thing to do as dealing with apartheid South Africa was. That means you mustn't buy their products, you mustn't invest in their industries, you mustn't collaborate with their institutions, and of course you mustn't go there to lie on the beach and enjoy the beautiful lands that have been stolen from someone else. Of course, I'm only getting snapshots, and it's going to be a long struggle. But I do believe that now we have an administration in the United States that would quite like public opinion to be shifting in the direction that I'm advocating. That's my explanation for the fact that I come into the United States now on a weekly basis. Today at JFK, I was a VIP visitor. I was given the most professional and courteous and expeditious passage through the airport. This despite the continuing barking from the crazed outer limits of the Zionist lobby, which continues to greet my every arrival with a hue and cry that somehow I'm a terrorist or a supporter of terrorism. The U.S. government is not buying that, and that's quite useful. I think you mentioned the exclusion of Noam Chomsky, an 82-year-old professor of MIT in Boston, who is a world-renowned intellectual and a man of peace. When Netanyahu bans him from entering the occupied Palestinian territories, frankly, that probably does more for us than the visit of Professor Chomsky would have done.
I can't help, you specifically mentioned a one-state solution. Is that the position? Because, frankly, it would seem that there's almost no viable landmass any longer for a two-state solution. But could you elaborate more on how you've come to that particular position? And indeed, is that what you would consider to be the prominent position of the mass of Palestinian people now?
Because I have all my life been aligned with the line of the late President Arafat, I supported the Oslo Agreement. I supported it because I was persuaded by him that this was the best attainable, best achievable solution to the tragedy, the disaster, the catastrophe. But the absolute failure to implement the Oslo Agreement, alongside the physical obliteration of the land on which such a solution could have been created, crafted, the building of the apartheid wall, the ethnic cleansing of Jerusalem, the starvation and murder of Gaza, has led me to the conclusion that Israel has no intention of allowing a two-state solution. So if there isn't going to be a two-state solution, why should I fight for one? Especially when the solution I advance of a democratic state where all Muslims, Christians and Jews live as equal citizens under the law is, of course, intellectually, morally, ideologically, the superior solution. When the Boers in the Orange Free State asked Mandela at the end of apartheid if they could have the Orange Free State for a white republic, he answered, "We don't believe in white states or black states. We just believe in democratic states where every person is equal." And if that was good enough for post-apartheid South Africa, it must be good enough for post-apartheid Palestine.
If I could get one last question, which is I'm most interested in your thoughts now with the deposing, if you will, of Gordon Brown of Labour and the new government, consolidation government, under the leadership, really, of the Conservatives. You've spoken about Barack Obama. How do you address or look at the role, really, of Great Britain now and its government in relationship to one of your primary causes and concerns, which is really free Palestine?
Well, it'll be even worse. The British government that's just left office was an extremely bad one. It led Britain into more wars in fewer years than any ruler of Britain, royal or common, in all British history, and left office dripping with the blood of a million Iraqis and an untold number of Afghans, and complicity in the Israeli assault on Lebanon in 2006, complicity in the Israeli assault on Gaza in 2008-09, as well as sundry betrayals of our own people at home. But the Conservative government will be even worse. The one saving grace is that it has no mandate. Nobody voted for this unholy alliance of people who believe one thing, or at least said they believed one thing in the election, the Liberal Democrats, who've now vault fast and appear now to pretend to believe something else. Between the two of them, there are deep fissures below the leadership level. The Conservative rank and file want a red in tooth and claw Conservative government, the sort of Gingrich-type government. The Liberal Democrats, below the leadership level, are a much milder and more moderate formation. So it's an unstable government. I don't believe that it will last for the whole of the 5 years they intend it to last. But there are disturbing straws in the wind. The new Foreign Secretary, William Hague, is particularly aggressive on the subject of Iran. He has, for several years now, been pushing the most warlike intention towards the nuclear standoff with Iran. This can only be bad. And a recent British television documentary made by a conservative commentator by the name of Peter Oborne for Channel 4 television showed in chapter and verse the takeover of the Conservative Party's leadership office by Zionist funding and lobbying activity. So the Conservatives spent twice as much on the election as Labour did, not by American standards a big amount of money, but £22 million, $35 million plus, twice as much as Labour spent, and almost all of it came from donations from rich supporters of Israel. So there's no reason to believe that the Conservative government is going to be less of a friend of Netanyahu than the outgoing Labour government. There's every reason to believe it will be even more.
And is there any possibility that the Labour Party in Britain will start acting like a Labour Party? Is there any dynamic within that for change?
You're good. That's exactly the $64,000 question in Britain.
I've got 128,000 right now.
That's right. Will the British Labour Party be a Labour Party again, or will it continue on the trajectory of the last 15, 16 years toward the liquidation, really, of a Labour Party? If it's the latter, then respect the party to which I belong, and other developments will have to try and fill that vacuum. If it's the former, and it begins to be a Labour Party again, then all of us will have to reevaluate our relationship to it. There's a leadership campaign going on now. It remains to be seen just exactly how that will pan out. But over the next few months, we'll get some sign.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
We'll be talking with George Galloway, former member of the British Parliament and founder of Viva Palestina.
Well, this has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash.